From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was first made November 11th, 1919. President Woodrow Wilson proclaimed that day Armistice Day, saying, quote, "To us in America, the reflections of Armistice Day will be filled with solemn pride in the heroism of those who died in the country's service and with gratitude for the victory, both because of the thing from which it has freed us and because of the opportunity it has given America to show her sympathy with peace and justice in the councils of the nations." Looking, of course, at World War I. Well, in 1945, a World War II veteran led a delegation that urged expanding Armistice Day to celebrate all veterans, not just those who died in the First World War. And Congress amended the act in 1954, replacing Armistice with veterans, and so it has been ever since. In 2014, there are profound questions for how our veterans are treated, what services are available to them, how we can help with the problem of homelessness, joblessness, and more. If you want to join the conversation, we'd like to hear from you. Maybe you've got a veteran in your family, or maybe you are a veteran. We would like to talk about those issues as we approach Veterans Day. My guest is Todd Baxter, the Executive Director of the Veterans Outreach Center. Todd, nice to see you here.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Let me start by telling you about a phone call I got this morning because I want to make sure I am not offending anybody.
Great.
Somebody called, left a message, said they're a big fan of the program, but they're very sensitive to the for how we pronounce the word veteran, and they prefer three syllables and not two. Have you heard that before?
Never heard. That's a first.
Okay. That's a first. So I'm deferring to the Veterans Outreach Center director. Is it three or two?
Well, I'm going to go with three, and I'm going to do the old clap your hands, veteran.
Okay, all right. So hence, thus forth, it will be three syllables, and if I make a mistake, please know it is not intended to offend. I would certainly never intend to offend, especially as we talk about ways to honor our veterans and make sure that they're taken care of. So let me start with this, Todd. It's been almost a year for you there, and as you now have a much firmer grasp on the scope of veterans' issues in our area, what stands out to you as the biggest needs?
Well, the biggest need is being prepared for these guys and gals coming home. President Obama announced a few short months ago that he's going to reduce forces to a pre-World War II size. So in my world, that means a lot of displaced, unemployed veterans that have served their country for a couple years or almost 20 if they haven't received a retirement at the other end of it. We got to be ready for them coming back in our community, which offers a great opportunity for us to accept all those great Americans back home and be productive members of our society. But they need that help transitioning.
And when it comes to transitioning, we're talking about getting into the workforce and sort of reassimilating. And there will be different sort of mental health needs based on case to case. What's the biggest gaping hole for someone who's coming home? Is it joblessness? Is it mental health?
Well, the biggest, if you look at it, these folks are coming back into a society they've been out of for years, whether it's they've been out of just because of the number of years they've been away from the home of record, or they've been living in a different culture for many years, the military culture, a very structured event, a very structured way of life, fighting a war for over 10 years now. It's like moving to a new country. They're coming back home, but they're moving to a new country. So getting them assimilated back into the society is the most difficult thing for us to do. The people we're seeing at the Veterans Outreach Center, we're seeing them 2 to 3 years after they leave active duty or left a deployment. They're not coming right off the active duty and coming to see us. They're coming when they have issues after they try to get back into society. So we really want to get that outreach to them and get them their supportive services ahead of time. Some of them are just fine. They just need that step to get back into society. Other ones, you know, are realizing a lot of issues that they've experienced after 10 years of war fighting will wear a person out.
Now, when it comes to what the Veterans Outreach Center does, give me a sense for the mission within your doors and then some of the broader resources that you kind of connect to. Because sometimes it's a question of, do you do it? Do you connect someone to other services? What's going on?
And you nailed a good point there. That's the point of confusion for most veterans. Where do I go and who's the one-stop shop for us? The Veterans Outreach Center was designed 42 years ago to fill a gap that the VA could not do. It's not anti-VA. It's really here to fill a gap locally and take care of supportive services on a local front with the community-based programs. The four big things we do right now, we serve a homeless population with over 56 beds for homeless veterans here in the Rochester community. We do a lot of homeless prevention where we work through legal issues, emotional issues, landlord-tenant problems, anything we do to prevent a veteran from becoming homeless. We do wellness training to take care of the emotional needs of a veteran and their families also and the kids. And then we do a lot of job placement, trying to marry veteran-supported organizations that are looking to hire veterans and get those skill sets veterans come out of the military with into their different facilities. So we spend a lot of time trying to create opportunities for veterans to get work.
We're talking to Todd Baxter, the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center in Rochester. As we approach Veterans Day, we're going to be talking in a moment about a big event they have coming up next week. If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. When it comes to rates of homelessness and rates of joblessness, let me start with homelessness. Mm-hmm. You mentioned having beds available.
Correct.
And homelessness is sort of easily misunderstood. I think we think of stereotypes, mm-hmm. and sometimes there's reality. Sometimes we see people living in under a bridge. Sometimes we see people living outside and just trying to get by. But let's start with, in general, the rate of homelessness. How are we doing with veteran homelessness in our area?
Yeah, we're definitely driving the rate down, and that's a lot of great things the VA is doing through local community opportunities. It's still there. For instance, our homeless shelter, I've been there. Every month I've been there, we've had a waiting list in our homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. We have to place veterans in other organizations, go back to the VA and put a veteran back into a VA facility. So there's a need. The need has not gone away, and the fact is we're trying our best to drive it down. We're doing some great services that we can definitely share with you, but there's still a rate that's more than the capacity that we're able to fulfill, and that's a sad thing.
Okay, so the local rate's going down, but if a veteran comes to you mm-hmm. and your beds are filled, can you help them find somewhere else?
It's not can, we will. I mean, that's our mission. And whether we put them on the couch inside the office, you know, they're not going away, especially on an inclement weather. We have rules that we're governed by, but also the city can create a program with the stroke of a pen by the mayor to allow us to increase the number of beds in our facilities.
I was going to ask you, I mean, do you need more beds?
Yeah, absolutely. We've contracted out with outside agencies to add beds to our facilities, and we do that for transitional housing right now. We're in the process right now of looking to possibly build another shelter or maybe increase our bedding other ways by, you know, signing memorandums or understanding with other organizations. We are in need of beds, absolutely. There's no doubt. And when we're holding five or six applications a week, there's definitely a need out there more in our capacity.
Okay. And so the reason you don't have more beds right now is simply an issue of money?
Yeah, it's a funding issue. It's really a size issue. Our two facilities we own right now over on South Avenue are at capacity. The folks over here will do anything they can to put a veteran in a shelter overnight. And you think about our shelters also, Evan, they're not designed to just house one night. Our shelters are designed about getting the veteran back into the society, and we keep them for up to 90 days at one shelter and over 2 years at another shelter to give them all the supportive services and get them back on their feet so they're productive members of society. Whatever causes the homelessness is just a symptom. You know, there's many underlying issues we have to get a hold of and get straightened out.
Jerry writes to us and says her brother was briefly homeless. He is a veteran, and she said that he was homeless in his 30s mm-hmm. and wants to remind us that it is not only older veterans who can go homeless and have trouble. Is it typically older veterans who end up homeless?
Yeah, phenomenal statistic most people don't think about. 41% are between the ages of 31 and 50 years old. You know, almost half of them between 31 and 50.
Wow.
It goes to that stat I said earlier about these folks are, not going in. They're not the 22-year-old person coming right out of the military. These are folks that tried to get back into society and had some kind of issues getting back in. Most of the people we're seeing are in that demographic. And then still we have some Vietnam, era folks that we're still serving in a homeless population. I think that's a testimony of the way we treated those guys and how we treated them when they came home and they didn't seek assistance in the VA. They were anti-government because of the way they were treated during the war and post-war. And we've corrected that. We as a society have done a great job correcting that. But I think we're still paying the piper for that one on how we treated those guys and gals when they came home.
Have you met, even in your less than a year in this job, have you met older veterans who have sort of admitted that they didn't ever want to receive services for those reasons? I mean, did that surprise you? Have you been seeing that?
Oh, yeah, you see it. Absolutely. In particular, the Vietnam era folks, they were just, and that's why the VOC started. If you think about it, the VOC started with Vietnam veterans 42 years ago, and the federal government realized that there was a gap there, and folks weren't coming to the VA for services. So they planted these veterans outreach centers, 18 of them throughout the nation. We're proud to say we're the only one left standing 42 years later. But they recognized that gap, that the government was not being utilized by the veterans, and they were going to realize problems with homelessness and addiction and everything else. So that's why we started as a Veterans Outreach Center over on South Avenue 42 years ago.
I go back to Jerry's comment about her brother being mm-hmm. briefly homeless in his 30s. And, whether you're 90 and a veteran or you're 22 or 25 or whatever your age, I mean, homelessness has to be wiped out. But if you think about two out of five veterans who are homeless between the ages of 31 and 50, you say?
That's correct.
I mean, these are people with decades of life left and hopefully workforce life left.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it has to be pressing to get help for them, not just get them off the street, but to get them sort of moving toward the workforce, right?
Exactly. They're our productive members of society. They're the ones that are going to be out there raising capital, paying taxes, and raising families in our communities. They can either be doing it as productive members of society or non-productive members. So it pays dividends for all of us as a community to take care of these folks. Not only it's the right thing to do, I think everybody agrees we should be taking care of our veterans.
Who funds the Veterans Outreach Center?
Most of our funding comes through for nonprofit. We have to raise our own funds. We have to pay for the salaries of most of our employees, turn on the lights, pay the insurance, all through raising funds. We do have some unique grants I could share with you. That's about another 50%, you know, comes through grants. And grants are great, but grants also drive what we have to do because we got to fulfill the grant. And then when they go away, so do those services. So we're always stuck behind the ability to get grants, but also to fill the grants and hope they don't go away in a timely manner that we can use, you know, and solve the problems that grant was designed for. So we're either doing fundraising or seeking grants and writing grants and fulfilling grants.
All right, let's talk briefly about what's happening next week. Next Thursday, the 6th, the Stars and Stripes, it's at 6 p.m. at the Convention Center. What's going on, Todd?
Well, that is our largest fundraiser, and we'd encourage people to come out for a couple of reasons. One, if you want to support the Veterans Outreach Center, it's the best way to do it. Buy a ticket to that. And I can guarantee you'll be entertained. It's a dinner, a sit-down dinner with a whole lot of pomp and circumstances, a whole lot of honor, a whole lot of tradition. So if you like military culture, if you want to honor veterans, that's a great opportunity. I'll give you a fantastic example. Gary Biker, living Medal of Honor winner here in the Rochester area, grew up in the town of Greece, served the Greece community for years, quietly behind the scenes. Most people don't even know he's wearing the Medal of Honor around his neck. Very humble gentleman. Next week, we get the opportunity to bring him up on stage and contrary to his beliefs and wants.
Good for
we're
you.
We're going to embarrass that man just a bit and pay respect to what he did.
I'm trying to remember the first time I met Gary, you know, back when I was a 13 Wham news reporter. And yeah, I mean, absolutely great for you to force him into the spotlight because he'll be so uncomfortable.
Yes.
He deserves to be uncomfortable just for a moment.
Please, absolutely.
I jest, but it's really a nice honor for someone like that. And again, you said it's 6 p.m. Is it 6 p.m.? I'm sorry.
It's 6 p.m. I believe the cocktail hour starts at 5:30.
Okay.
You know, and it's a dinner hour. It's going to be a couple-hour event. And, you know, we start out with the Keystone bagpipes coming in and the Junior ROTC presenting the colors. And the Gold Star families are coming out. Those are family members here from our community that lost loved ones in the war. And we're going to recognize those families there, too. And it's just all about tradition and respect and honor for our veterans.
Tickets are where, Todd?
Best way, easiest way, veteransoutreachcenter.org. Veteransoutreachcenter.org. First click, as soon as you get on the webpage, you'll see it.
Okay, that's a week from tonight at the Convention Center. And that will, you know, if fundraisers like that go well, those kind of proceeds go toward a number of things, but what's big in your mind that this will help?
Well, first of all, those proceeds stay right here on South Avenue. You know, those proceeds aren't going to a national organization. We get to spend that money right here locally on vets. And we do things that aren't grant funded. For instance, our vocational training. We have a schoolhouse over on South Avenue that looks like a computer lab when you walk into it. We train veterans on all Microsoft products, Microsoft Access, Excel. We teach them how to write resumes. We teach them how to do job searches on the internet. But in addition to that, we do vocational training. We do training, for instance, we certify them in forklifts. We certify sign language. We certify welding classes. Whatever it takes to take a veteran and the skill sets they learn now transition into what the current employers are looking for out in the real world to get them a job is what we do over that vocational. That's all funded by donations. That's not funded by any grant.
And without naming names, tell me about a few success stories you've seen this year.
Yeah, well, we got folks over at Harris Communications working for us right now. One gentleman, he's on our webpage. Well, I won't mention his name, but if you click on the webpage, you'll see him. fantastic sailor, served his country as a sailor. Came out, had a real difficult time, if you will, transitioning his military skills into civilian skills. Sat down with our people over at our reception center and worked on his resume, worked on his interview skills, took his military occupational skills and made that into a civilian resume that was very productive. Now he's got a great job, a career. He's working on his MBA, utilizing his GI Bill and moving forward as a very productive member of our society. You see those real world solutions. I'll give you another one we're working on right now and put a little pressure on some of our town supervisors. I met with the town supervisors and mayors about 3 months ago and gave them a briefing on what we do. And they said one of their biggest needs, they want to hire veterans, but one of their biggest needs is commercial driver's license certified folks, and they're saying, why can't we take a veteran that's driving a tanker truck in Afghanistan and put them behind our snowplows?
Absolutely.
And New York State had something to say about that. It's called, you know, take your driver's license test and pay us a fee. So we're working with the towns right now. They're going to fund through their department budgets our vocational training area to get that CDL driver's license done for our veterans, so we start putting these guys to work for our local towns, back in our local community. So that just shows you another success story of us just working with town supervisors and town mayors to make something productive happen, both for the vet and for the community.
How much do you view in about a year at your job, you now surveying the landscape and saying, there's red tape, I'm going to cut through that, yeah. There's red tape. I mean, how much is that happening?
That's awesome. That's more, that's probably what makes me most excited about going to work here. I worked for government since I was 18, either in the military or law enforcement. And the red tape and the bureaucracies can be stifling sometimes. Nonprofit gives you a lot of freedom to do what you need to do for whoever you're trying to help, and in our particular case, the veterans. And nothing better than busting down those barriers. Great example, we just went up to Fort Drum, and working with the City of Rochester Personnel Department and the City of Rochester Police Department, we were able to take the first civil service test, City of Rochester civil service test, to the veterans on active duty to hopefully put them on a civil service list for police officer here in the City of Rochester and recruit those veterans back to our community, even if they're not from here, but if they get established for a potentially good job, maybe they come back here looking for that job and using their GI Bill at one of our great learning institutions. So, you know, that's all red tape and bureaucracies. A lot of it gets done just by going and sitting down with people that want to help and breaking down those barriers.
Yeah, sometimes it takes someone in your position to help our leaders see it, because I don't think a lot of the red tape is ill-intended.
No.
And certainly, for example, you know, you talk about a license for a snowplow operator, those things. We probably do want those people driving those to have licenses. But when you realize some of the fees involved and some of those barriers, and you're telling a veteran who's driven some of the heavy machinery in the world in really rough terrain elsewhere that you still have to go through all this, then, you know, look, if I was leading Rochester, I might not have known that. And if for someone like you comes in, that helps. I would hope it helps.
Yeah, it definitely helps. And you know, you're not throwing darts at people. That gets us nowhere in life. What you do is you approach them and say, what's in it for you? You know, and everybody wants to know that. We're all humans, and we want to know what's in it for us. So what's in it for Todd Baxter is breaking down that red tape, getting a veteran a good job, and getting their family here. What's in it for the City of Rochester? They're recruiting veterans right off active duty. You can't get a better person for your police department than that. They have a huge push on minority hires. You got a whole new population of minority hires that you couldn't touch before that may be from Georgia, Alabama, or whatever, and now they're living at Fort Drum, so they're residents of our state. That's an untapped resource they didn't have before. So, yeah, though you got to look at it with, like, you know, it's not compromise. It's really that synergistic feeling you're trying to get of what's in it for you and what's in it for me, and let's talk about those things.
You talked about fundraising. As a nonprofit, you talk about grants. But what about regular sort of bureaucratic funding? Can the City of Rochester support you more? And how is your relationship with the city?
Well, our relationship with the city is fantastic. You know, I mentioned the police department, but that really comes from the support of the mayor's office. And Lovely Warren's been nothing but supportive since I've been there. I've met with her a couple times. I met with most of her staff for one reason or another. She did a proclamation for our Flag Day campaign this year and really stood up to the forefront of saying, you know, let's recognize our colors of our country and recognize veterans on the same day. Where some of the bureaucracy comes in, and we're doing a good job, is working with the state level. You know, for instance, civil service testing for a veteran, you have to be a resident of a certain location to take a test or get hired by that area. You know, we need to recognize the home of record of a veteran of any place in New York State. What I mean there is you might have a veteran that grew up in Georgia, his home of record is in Georgia. He's thinking about coming back to Rochester to use his GI Bill at Nazar, St. John Fisher, U of R, and possibly become a police officer, firefighter, or any other civil service job. The red tape from civil service laws is preventing that person potentially coming back here. So we want to break down those barriers. What we found, though, and what it's a beautiful thing, is no one wants to argue with us. No one wants to really come. Everybody wants to help a veteran. And even the red tape that's unintentional is able to be broken down just by conversations.
I want to mention to some of our listeners who are joining the conversation online, Jane and Mark have had some comments. We're going to get to those coming up here. Some very interesting questions, including questions about female veterans, which we're going to get to. I see the phones ringing now. If you want to join the conversation with Todd Baxter, the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center here in Rochester, you can do that at 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But before I move on from homelessness, how do we define homelessness again? Is it someone who comes in and says, I don't have a bed? Mm-hmm. how do we get beyond the stereotype of sort of the person under the living, unfortunately, in a garage, under the bridge, et cetera?
Yeah, well, first of all, we try and spend a lot of time, resource, in preventing homelessness, and we spend a lot of money. Our largest grant is designed about preventing homelessness, and we work with different organizations, Legal Aid Society, Rochester Housing Authority, Compeer, anybody we can sign agreements with to say, what are the underlying causes that's potentially causing this homeless person, and we want to prevent that. The other side of that is, you know, homelessness is not just, like you said, the person living under the bridge or living alongside I-490. Homelessness is that person that was living in a box in Henrietta. We have one of those people that live in a box in Henrietta in the Woodline and had a successful job working in a car industry. But the fact is he didn't have enough money and enough wherewithal to get himself proper shelter. And he lived in Henrietta in the Woodline for a couple of years before we got him to the Richards House over in South Ave. Homeless could be that veteran that was displaced, came up here for a job. The job fell through. Him, his wife, and two kids are sitting in our waiting room and saying, now we have to sustain ourselves because that job fell through and I came up here for the job. That's a real-world story I'm telling, that we at least coached him through the use of his GI Bill and got him food stamps to at least sustain the family till the next job opportunity comes up. So it's real world. It's not the person you're thinking of, just, you know, the down and out. It's families that are going through some difficult times.
And before I get to the phones, for those of us who have veterans in our family, and that's just about all of us, if hard times come, we probably, to state the obvious, shouldn't wait until they're in that stereotypical homelessness situation. They can be at risk before they're sort of traditionally homeless.
Yeah, and Evan, when you get a chance, let's talk about the Supportive Services of Veteran Family Grant that we received, SSVF. And that's all designed by the VA to take that money, decentralize that to local nonprofits, and allow us to prevent that homelessness. So if you have a loved one that's close to, maybe getting a shutoff notice from the RG&E, getting an eviction notice, you know, 90 days, pay your bill or get out type thing, they need to be on our door, and you need to be pushing them that way towards our door. We have a whole grant design, and I have a whole staff that are wonderful people just designed to prevent that homeless opportunity from occurring. We don't want it to occur. No one in society wants it to occur. And the best part about that is I think the VA did that right. They took that money and decentralized it, as opposed to the way we see the healthcare being run. And they're holding us accountable. Either we do it right or they take the money away. And we've been very successful placing hundreds of veterans in a successful program to prevent the homelessness from even occurring.
Yeah, I mean, being proactive and getting in front of it is a big difference.
Way cheaper also.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to get to the phones. I see our engineer is currently on the phone. Again, we're on with Todd Baxter, the Executive Director of the Veterans Outreach Center. And let me go ahead and... I see. That's okay. We lost a call there. Let me get to the question then that came in here online, one of them. This came from Jane, and Jane just says, what about female veterans? And that's a broad question.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I think what Jane is probably saying is it's easy for us to speak about it as if it's a male problem only. What are you seeing?
Well, that's a question we're asking ourselves, in particular at the Veterans Outreach Center. All veteran services agencies are asking that question. And here's the facts, and the facts play out. I think we're going to see a need that we're not ready for in the female population and the family population. One, the increased number of veterans that are females, the increased number of females going into the military is increased. That's an obvious. Just a few short years ago, we started allowing females into combat. So we would naturally expect more post-traumatic situations with females. With those females, we're finding they come out of the military with families, where most of the males don't come out with families. You know, so then we have a single mother with a kid or two. Whole different dynamic that we are looking at right now and literally conducting a study as we speak. Judge Patricia Marks, a retired judge from a local bench here, is running that for us, and Sergeant Major Josie Henderson, that works for me. And they're putting together a committee to say, all right, we know there's going to be females. We know, but what are they coming back with that is different than the males, if anything? But we really don't have a clear picture of that, of what we should be doing, in particular the Veterans Outreach Center, for the female population. We expect they'll be coming through our doors more often. We expect they're going to be coming through with kids. And here's the point I'm saying we're not ready. We don't have a homeless shelter bed in Monroe County for female veterans. And that's incredible. Our shelter's all males. We signed some great MOUs with ABW and YWCA to make sure we're ready in case we get a female that really needs housing, and we've worked great with those folks. But just as a Veterans Outreach Center, we need to identify problems that they're going to have and come up with possible solutions. So we're doing that study as we speak.
All right. So right now, 56 beds, all male.
All male. All single male. Yes.
What
no families.
Happens if a female veteran comes through the door then with the same problem?
Yeah, we're going to go to our other supportive services. You know, the county runs 17 homeless shelters. The lady that runs our homeless shelter, Judy Gilbert, does a fantastic job. She's in that community, the homeless community. She knows everybody at the city of Rochester. She knows all the other shelters. We are not going to turn that female veteran away. I mean, again, we'll put them on the floor with a tent. These are veterans in my office. They're not going to get turned away, and their family's not going to get turned away. I mentioned ABW, YWCA. You know, these are folks that would help us any way they could also that we have relationships with.
All right. And you mentioned that a female veteran is much more likely to be a parent, have a family, sometimes a single parent. And Mark is asking about divorce rates, mental health, and counseling. I don't know, I haven't looked up myself, if divorce rates are higher or veterans are coming back and having trouble keeping marriages together. Offhand, does that stand out to you, Ted?
That's going to be an assumption on my behalf. I haven't looked at statistics either, but we do know the stressors on these families is incredible. In particular, the reservists that have been deployed several times and coming back and jumping back into the family environment and then leaving again. And that's happened for some veterans several times. I met a veteran the other day who's been deployed 10 times, double digits.
And that's 10 times?
10 times in the last 14 years deployed.
Oh my goodness.
So every time that happens, you know, that's the stress on the family of leaving. That's the stress of, is everybody safe? That's the stress of the family caretaker at home. There's a lot of work at home to be taken care of. You know, it's almost more stressful to be home and taking care of those two kids when your loved one's overseas. When you're overseas, you got the danger part of it, but your life is pretty static. Your life is pretty, you know, do what the boss says, and you know, you're going to eat this time, and you're going to be there. Home life doesn't end. You know, you got the school events and all the stressors. So, it's a burden upon families that a lot of people don't even think about. You know, we spend a lot of time over on South Avenue with our wellness training, you know, getting those families through our door and talking with the kids and doing different types of therapies. We have art therapy. We do sand therapy where we get the kids in and, you know, just do stuff with sands with a certified therapist and gets the kid to open up. We're working right now with horses, you know, and trying to get the veterans to work more with horses, both in riding with horses and also like a leadership thing with a horse. We're doing some stuff for the psychologists out in Hamlin. Whatever it takes, Evan, to get these families, to get these members to open back up. So you can see right there, we're filling the gap the VA is really not designed to do. If we have a real, real stressful or real bad post-traumatic, we're going to send them to the VA. They've got great doctors. The doctors here in Monroe County are fantastic. They love their veterans. They'll do anything. But also, they don't really have the time or capacity to do art therapy or do canine therapy that we can fill the gap in.
Todd, I've told the story on this program before. I had some friends who, wasn't that long ago, we were talking to them and a married couple, and they said, oh, we went to counseling last week. I said, counseling, is everything okay? And they said, yeah, why? And I said, well, you know, there's the stereotype that you're not going to go to therapy or counseling unless there's a problem. And they said, well, do you brush your teeth every day? I said, several times a day. And they said, well, you don't wait till you have a cavity to brush your teeth. Yeah. But that is not the most people do not end up going to counseling or therapy sort of proactively. And I imagine for veterans, it can be even more difficult to figure out when that moment is where you need some kind of help, whether it's recognizing PTSD or just dealing with depression and other issues that may come in. It can be, there can be pride, there can be questions on just recognizing it. I mean, there could be questions on how to afford treatment for it. Mm-hmm. So those questions have to be regular and very difficult.
Nonstop. And the great point you brought up is first of all, these are prideful people. They were drilled to have pride since the first day they entered the military and have honor and be tougher than the average person. Here's a great way to think about this. You know, everybody that's gone in the military and been at least in a combat area would probably come back with some kind of post-traumatic stress. Notice I didn't put the word disorder in there. It'd be abnormal if they didn't come back with a whole lot of stress in their life. Just the fact that we talked about earlier, deploying, with the stress on the family, the fact that they may have seen some difficult things overseas. It might not be a post-traumatic stress disorder, but it definitely you would expect all of us would be perfectly normal to come back with post-traumatic stress. So what I always tell the veterans that are such proud people when I see them is, sir, ma'am, you're feeling that way is 100% normal. There's nothing wrong the way you're feeling. That's the way the body should react to what you just went through. So, you know, you got to break down those stereotypes yourself and get in here and get some assistance. And the other side of that equation, Evan, is 22 veterans a day commit suicide, which is a dumbfounding statistic that we need to get a hold of these guys and gals as they're coming back, getting off the airplane and saying, look, you're gonna realize some stress. Don't worry about that, and let's get you into some type. Even if you're just talking to other veterans about what you did, that's great therapy. Just, you know, sitting in a social event, talking about it, and then moving on with your life when you feel comfortable. But totally normal to feel a little abnormal, if you will. And that's where we got to break down this stereotype.
All right. I see that Mariana had called earlier and just wanted to kind of leave a message with our listeners and with the show about horses, and you mentioned it. Yeah. So she was talking about the Equicenter giving horseback riding lessons for free to veterans, mm-hmm. gardening as well. Is that yep. the same thing that we're talking about?
That's one of two programs that we're looking at. Well, Equicenter's been nothing but great to veterans. That one's kind of unique. I went out and visited those great people out there, and Mr. Friedlander is a friend of a good friend of mine who was a city police officer. And you know, getting on that horse and during therapy where you're riding and the horse is mimicking your natural body reactions, and it's more of a physiological therapy. Mm-hmm. And now they're working with Cornell Cooperative Extension about getting our veterans and getting their hands dirty, you know, and actually learning how to grow your own food and maybe even getting into the farming industry, you know, as a potential job and career path. And New York State is big on that right now. And on the other side, we're doing some work out in Hamlin with a psychologist that's looking to use, and he does some therapy with horses, and you don't even get on the horse. You just get into a stable with a horse, which is very intimidating. You build a relationship with the horse, and then you start creating an environment where the horse will do things for you and you'll do things for the horse, and it's another form of therapy. So yeah, we'll use anything we can get. And you nailed it earlier that we don't do it all, but we want to know these people from the Equicenter. We want to know these people that can do it for our veterans.
And Mariana wants to let our listeners know that, again, obviously you can call the Veterans Outreach Center, but the Equicenter number, 624-7777.
624-7777.
If they've got Todd Baxter's endorsement, they're obviously
doing pretty good things. And when I was out there, it wasn't all veterans. There was kids that were having some issues that needed some work, and it was families out there. And it's a beautiful place. If you ever get out there, you're going to want to actually move in. It's a gorgeous piece of property.
All right, Mariana, thanks for the call there. Let's take a very short break. And when we come back, more of your comments that are coming in on Twitter and questions for Todd Baxter, the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center. Questions about World War II vets and a few other things that we'll get to next. And as we talk about Veterans Issue approaching 2014 Veterans Day, you're listening to Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our next hour, the Whiteness Project. Is there an advantage to being white, especially in the United States of America? A new project interviewed 21 white people from Buffalo, asking them for their experiences as a white person. Some said, yes, there are absolutely advantages. Others thought, boy, the discrimination these days is against the white race. We examine all of it next hour.
For cameraman Lou Bloom, car crashes and homicides mean survival. They feed the beast of morning TV.
You get a call, you don't know what you're going to be seeing. And there's a terror there, but you can feel from them an excitement too.
Actor Jake Gyllenhaal on his new film about video and voyeurism, Nightcrawler, later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections with Todd Baxter, the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center in Rochester. And as we get ready to go back to the phones, here's a comment from Twitter. Asking, given the stories about the military's mishandling of injured servicemen, I'd be interested to hear what World War II veterans are saying and what their experiences have been. Have you seen anything on that score, Todd?
I'm not too sure of the question, but one of the things I thought about when I started working on the veteran service community was like, why is, you know, and I've talked to psychologists about this. I've talked to other people who have been in the industry way longer than I mean, what has changed over the years? It seems like the World War II generation, the greatest generation of all time, didn't have all these issues and weren't so needed of services post-war and things like that. And a couple of things came to light, and this, again, nothing statistical to back it up, of just my observations. One, if you look at the World War II generation, they were tougher people, and I'm talking about tougher than Todd Baxter. I'm not trying to bring anybody else down, but my generation grew up a lot softer, a lot easier. You know, the World War II generation grew up through the Great Depression. You know, they knew of sacrifice. They knew of difficult life. And on the other side of it, when they came out of the war, it wasn't traditional. You didn't talk to a veteran and tell them to open up to you. You didn't talk about art therapy and horse therapy and all the other things. And it was very non-traditional. You kept that stuff inside your family, just like you kept family problems. You mentioned, you know, going to counseling a second ago. That was abnormal back then. And I'm sure that a lot of internal things occurred in families and individuals because we didn't take care of them emotionally and physically as they came back. And I think humans are still the same. So I think they're a little more resilient. Because they were a little tougher generation, but also we probably didn't do just the right things for them that we're trying today. And a lot of lessons were learned via, you know, post-Vietnam, too, of what we did with our veteran population. We asked these guys, and think about that generation. They weren't a volunteer service like our for services today. You know, they were drafted, they were drawn, they were dragged, you know, into that war zone, then treated like junk when they came home. Well, you're creating a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, interesting. Right, let's get Dale in Geneva. Dale, you're on with Todd Baxter. Thanks for calling.
I just have a minor question. I was in the Air Force from 1966 to 1970. And as you probably know, most veterans, or most military, don't see combat. They're in backup positions, they're on board ship or an aircraft. You know, they very few of the veterans actually see combat. All right, and I was one of the ones that did not. I was stationed in a missile unit in the United States. Well, when I was separated, you had to turn in your ID card. And now, because I went to work for a private company and have a private retirement, the VA tells me that I can't get a VA card that identifies me as a veteran.
Is it Dale? I'm sorry, Dale?
Yeah.
Dale, well, you're not the only one that's ever brought that up to me in just a few short months I've been here. And you're similar to a lot of folks that served in the reserve system. For instance, you signed up for the military. You served 6 years in a peacetime reserve unit. You did your weekends. You volunteered to go to your to be drafted, you know, to go to war, but it never occurred. And then you depart from the military after 6 years. You have no DD-214. You have no ID card either. So you guys are in a very difficult position. It's not even the gray area position we talk about when someone retires from reserve.
Well, I have a 214. I was on active duty from 66 to 70.
Here's the solution to the problem, because I brought this up to Louise Slaughter's office, and I'll give her credit that she introduced a bill before I even brought it up. And the bill states just that. If you served in active duty, if you served your country honorably, and you're not eligible for a retirement ID card, or you can't get a VA ID card because you're seeking medical treatment, which is another form of ID, you folks just in your same position, if this legislation goes through, that we'll all be able to get an ID card that allows us to at least seek the benefits that most veterans have coming, whether it's discounts at the Home Depot and local stores, or it's other services that we can get, you know, whether you're going to a PX on a military installation or whatever. So the legislation's out there, and you can get way more detail than that from Louise Slaughter's office, but she did introduce a bill to take care of folks like you. I believe that's the solution to the problem.
All right. Good enough. Thank you.
Dale, go ahead, Dale.
I would like to say something else, what you were just referring to. My father was in the Navy from 1940 to 1960, and he was torpedoed on a ship. And what you were just referring to about the World War II vets?
Yes, sir.
He did not start having problems until he was in his 80s.
Wow.
And my mother would call me up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. My father would wake up screaming in bed, trying to swim in his bed because he was in the water for so long.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I used to sit back with my mother and cry because, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
He's 80 years old. There's not much, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's been probably carrying that around with him for years and years and years. Maybe it's just manifesting after all the time. But, boy, the scar tissue these guys come out with and these gals come out with is incredible.
Yeah, it was horrible to watch him.
Well, thanks for your dad's service and your service also.
Yes, Dale, thank you. And thank you for the call and sharing the story. Hard to hear that, but unfortunately, you know, that's not an outlier. That's you hear that at the Veterans Outreach Center all the time.
I mean,
variations of stories like that.
Absolutely.
Don't you?
Everybody screams in a different way, you know, and that's just a simple fact, and I equate it to my 26 years as a law enforcement officer and watching firefighters, and you know, we all see different things, we all react to it different. Some of us are just fine after a stressful event, other people react different, and we're all wired different. And, you know, I think of the Tony DiPanzios of the world that you know, was actually almost murdered. He was shot through the head, brain injury. He just finished his master's degree and he's working back at the police department, you know, and who knows what kind of symptoms he's having behind the doors, but he's living a very productive life right now. You just never know how we're going to react as human beings. And then maybe it's age that kicks it off, like Dale's father, years and years later, it brings it out. But the point I made to Dale, I think, is we're all carrying that with us. If you were part of stressful events and seen that type of stuff and lived through that, it's in you. You might be manifested in different ways, but it's in you.
I have a comment online from Tony who wants to ask about substance abuse. And Tony said, I don't want to be too specific or personal, but you haven't touched much on substance abuse. And Todd, that reminded me of what I was reading in USA Today, a story about veteran homelessness. And here in USA Today, quoting from a story there, 45% of participants in the VA's homeless program have a diagnosable mental illness, and more than 3 out of 4 have or have had substance abuse problems. 35% of participants in the VA homeless program have both a diagnosable mental illness and a substance abuse problem. Mm-hmm. So Tony's asking us just to briefly touch on this. And again, if you've missed it, I know there's all kinds of different services that not only the Veterans Outreach Center provides, but other agencies you work with. How often do you see substance abuse?
Probably more than the statistics just realized.
Even more
yeah,
than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The folks in our homeless shelter, I mentioned earlier, the homelessness is a symptom of many other things going wrong in the veteran's life. And then also the substance abuse is usually a symptom of I can't control the other things. And it's a modification that they're trying to control their feelings or their lack of ability to sustain, you know, a life here in society and get back into society. Many, many reasons that we have brilliant psychologists and drug treatment people that deal with. But the accurate fact is that our homeless population usually has some type of underlying issues, whether it's substance abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic violence, can't sleep, post-traumatic, so they're losing their careers and their jobs, even though law said they had to keep that job to come back to. They do, and then they lose it after they come back after 2 years because they haven't slept most nights and they're not showing up to work on time or they're sick. It's just a big, big, mess, if you will, and that's what we do so well at the Veterans Outreach Center. Come on, you're different. Everybody's a different individual, and come on and get a full comprehensive review. We're going to take care of the homelessness because you can't really fix all the other problems unless they got a cool, safe, comfortable place to stay with a good person and facility looking over them. And then you really got to work. And that's why we keep them for 90 days and sometimes up to 2 years. You know, come on in. We're going to take all those underlying issues and see how much we can fix those before we, you know, you go back into society and recreate the wheel again. And it's out there, substance abuse. And the working relationship we have with other institutions, I mentioned Compeer is from one example mm-hmm. of just peer-to-peer mentoring, you know, to all the way to the in-house treatment plants programs up at the VA in Canandaigua, where we can take our veterans. We have great relationships with them, and we'll send veterans right to them. They'll open up the doors at domicile, and they come in and they stay there for in-house treatment programs. So each person's individual is an individual, and that's how we look at them when they walk through the door. But yes, substance abuse, huge problem for us. Another thing on substance abuse, if I can hit on it,
yeah,
it's the medication for the pain. And we see this with young kids in a different transition into it, young kids getting stuck on mom and dad's or grandma's pain medications, then all of a sudden they're heroin addicts, you know, mm-hmm. with the Oxycontins and Oxycodones and things like that. And same thing, a veteran injured in a war, injured in training, and you're feeding them these pills, and then you release them back into society with that addiction. And I've seen a couple. I was talking to a gentleman just the other day from the town of Gates. Great family, raised by two good parents, you know, went to the local high schools, went off to the military as a great individual and got stuck on opiates and then came back and he was an addict when he came back. He was an addict when he left the military.
Isn't that such a great challenge for our medical community in that so often, you know, these terrible injuries require mm-hmm. pain medication or some kind of amelioration of those symptoms, but the addictive possibility is frightening.
Incredible. We hear, you know, you don't hear veterans, you hear people out of Hollywood, you hear people that you look up into in different walks of life. Yeah, they're addictive. It's really that simple, and we've really got to monitor and medicate the right way, and then of course find other ways to modify that pain outside of those addictive drugs. But if you're going to have to give those addictive drugs, it better come with a whole lot of checks and balance system, because it's not the individual as much as it's the drug. You know,
and that's why I think the fact that at the Veterans Outreach Center, 90 days to 2 years is it's important that you leave that window open, because beating addiction doesn't happen at the snap of a finger, no matter how badly somebody might want it.
No matter how many beautiful kids they have waiting at home for them to return and be mom or dad, no matter if they got a beautiful wife and a great job and, you know, it's an addiction. That's why we call it an addiction. You know, at the Richards House, you know, when they come through the doors, one of the things they have to do is turn in all their narcotics to us. They're prescribed narcotics, and we lock those up, and we issue those out per the doctor's orders to the veteran. And It sounds degrading, but it's a checks and balance system I'm talking about again. Again, these people are away from home. They got dragged away from their families. They're having some serious issues in their life, let alone throw a narcotic at them that's addictive. So we try and do as much as possible. We work great with the doctors. We work great with the VA staff to see how we can take care of that.
We're talking to Todd Baxter, who's the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center in Rochester. November 11th, of course, Veterans Day coming up. And before I get back to one other topic on homelessness, Todd, for people who had missed it, we're a week away from one of your most significant events of the year, and give us a sense for what's coming up with Stars and Stripes.
Yeah, Stars and Stripes. Again, it's all about honor and tradition. If you like the military, if you like pomp and circumstances, if you like the convention center food, come on out. It's a great event. We start out with bagpipes and the Keystone bagpipe group out of Gates. Junior ROTC, the young kids will be out there presenting our family, our colors of our nation. We are going to try our best to embarrass and humble Gary Biker, a living Medal of Honor winner right here from our community. Read his story online. Look at what that man did, both in the Vietnam War. I was just surrounded by death and almost died several times just saving other people, total strangers. True American hero. We need to recognize him and the Gold Star families. Great event. And folks, we need to turn on our lights. And if you want to help us, this is a great way to spend some time with some great Americans and help us turn on our lights.
6 p.m. next Thursday night at the Convention Center. You can find tickets right now on the website, which is?
VeteransOutreachCenter.org.
Okay. And you've been hearing from Todd throughout the hour about the various things they'd like to do. Do you have a timeline for building a new shelter? I mean, if things go well, it could happen when?
Yeah, one of the things, I shouldn't let too many cats out of the bag, but I would like to look at the two buildings that we own on South Avenue that are currently homeless shelters and see what we should do with those buildings. Should we expand upon them? Should we sell them? The South Wedge neighborhood has gone up, you know, in property values. Should we leave them alone and build additional beds somewhere else? Should we rehab another building? We're really in that stage right now, working through both the finances part of it, but also what's the location we want. We just did a matrix on location choices, and we have some folks from the realtor world out looking at some potential locations to maybe rehab a building somewhere close to the South Wedge neighborhood or early, you know, close into Henrietta and areas like that are on the bus line for us, so we can, you know, keep our veterans close to us, but also, you know, let them back out in the community. We're really looking for that transitional housing. How do we take veterans that have been in our supportive housing and now do the transitional housing with them?
Okay, so the bottom line is you're looking at a lot of options. You don't have a timeline yet, but with a successful fundraising effort, you'll have more options, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what it's all about. Again, we're not going to get a grant to build a new building. You know, we're going to get a grant to run supportive services for veteran families. But the fact is, if we have veterans every day, and the question earlier about what are we going to do with these female and family veterans that are coming home, in particular with the downsizing of the military, they're going to come back and a certain percentage are going to need our help. It's a proven fact. It's math. And we need to be ready for these folks and give them that good, you know, we're nothing about welfare. You know, we're nothing about, these guys don't want anything given to them. They just want a stepping stone back into society.
We've got some nice comments online. Shelley says, thanks so much for spending the hour on such an important issue. I think of my husband and my dad. Shelley, we're happy to do it. And I'll wrap with, this question, Todd. We're heading for the rough winter season. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about homelessness. Do things get more extreme or more challenging, and how do you handle when things really get... I mean, last winter was really brutal, and hopefully we're not going to see that brutal, but every year you've got challenges over the winter.
Yeah, well, first of all, and this is a great program the city has, and when the city declares an emergency, we're allowed by fire code to increase our number of beds. You know, right now we're at maximum capacity because of fire codes and the number of beds we have in there, but we can, you know, throw out the sleeping bags on the floor and get the couches out and put the cots out. We're not going to let a veteran walk out on a 32-degree day by any means. And all the other shelters do the exact same thing. So there should be no need for a veteran to be out there freezing cold in this inclement weather. Come down to South Avenue, walk in our doors, and we will put you up someplace and we're not going to release them out into the inclement weather. The other part of it is then on how do we sustain that? And it's exactly what we're talking about. We have a capacity issue, and we're going to constantly, you know, pursue that problem and see what we can do about it.
Todd, we got about a minute left here. We've been talking about the challenges. I know you're an optimistic guy. Yeah. What makes you most optimistic? We've been talking about some of the difficulties veterans face. What makes you most optimistic now?
Well, that's going to be twofold. One, society loves their veterans. Society is willing to take care of their veterans. It's not a difficult thing to talk about when I go out and talk about fundraising to folks. The other thing is, if you come down the South Avenue, you walk through the door, you're going to find 40 employees that probably could be making money a little more lucrative somewhere else and doing their you know, some of these people have master's degrees and are working for a fraction of what they can make because they believe in what they're doing. They believe in taking care of veterans. They believe if they touch a veteran, that rate of 22 veterans a day dying at their own hands is almost nullified if we can get our hands on them. They believe in creating new training opportunities for veterans. So the beautiful part, the optimistic part, is I got 40 employees that could be doing other things that are there for veterans every day, and that's what they want to do.
And are you happy?
Oh, couldn't be happier, as you can tell.
Well, you are. It's always interesting to talk to Todd because when you went over, how long ago was it now that you went to the Grace Police Department? When was that?
I went in 2010, February 2010.
Time flies,
yeah,
doesn't
absolutely.
It? So three, almost four great years there.
I did four years and a month. Yeah,
4 years and a month there, yeah. And now at the Veterans Outreach Center in Rochester, you've got a sense for all those things. If you want to check them out more online or more tickets, once again, the website is Todd.
VeteransOutreachCenter.org, sir.
Well, it's great to see you. Thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.
And again, always send our best to the men and women who've served this country.
Thank you. God bless. Thank you.
All right, so short break, and we turn our attention to a very interesting project you might have seen on PBS Online called The Whiteness Project. That is next on Connections.